So without further ado, I would actually like to now introduce Anne Wright. Anne has spent 29 years in the U.S. Army and Army Reserves, where she held the rank of colonel. She has primarily served in special ops units and is airborne qualified. Anne continued serving her work with the State Department, and for several years functioned as the Deputy Chief of Mission for multiple U.S. embassies. She received the State Department's award for heroism during her tenure in Sierra Leone. She was on the first team to go into Kabul, Afghanistan, in December of 2001 to help reopen the U.S. embassy there. Anne resigned from the U.S. Foreign Service in March of 2003 as a protest against the war in Iraq. Her action ended her career in the service, but it also opened some eyes and some doors for other forms of public service, primarily that of speaking out, standing for a policy of truth and integrity, and urging others to do so as well. Some of you may know of her participation in the documentary film Uncovered, The Truth About the Iraq War. Anne may have resigned her State Department office, but she has definitely not resigned to accept the status quo. Please join me in welcoming Anne Wright.
Thank you, Erica. It's a pleasure to be here at the Veterans for Peace Conference. This organization is such an important one, and with the new one that formed 2 years ago, Iraq Vets Against the War, joining another group, Vietnam Veterans Against the War. We've got a lot of people that have been veterans that say no to this war in Iraq, no to future wars, ceasefire in the Middle East. Today we're going to be talking with women who have served our country. I was in the U.S. military for 29 years, back in the era when there were very few women really that were in the military. Less than 1% of the women, the people that we had in the U.S. military were women when I first joined up. Most of them were in the medical field as nurses and doctors. I was in the Women's Army Corps. It was a very small number of women we had then. How many of you all are women veterans? Great. Thank you all. Thanks for your service. And you've got the history of how women have been in the military. Many of you, I think, were in even before I was. And we will be looking toward your voices as we speak about women's issues. Today we're going to be hearing from three women, all who have experienced things that they're living with right now, the concerns that on a variety of issues. We're going to go back to the Vietnam War. Colleen Hofstetter is going to tell us what happened to her during Vietnam and the things she's been dealing with, as many of you all have, from that era, and particularly women who have endured the same types of things that men have, but we talk more in terms generally of what men are dealing with and haven't recognized that women have been dealing with some of the same issues and then some different issues too. Then we're going to go to the current war that we're in right now, the war in Iraq. And we have with us Ellie Painted Crow, a Native American. Native Americans are serving in greater numbers right now in the Iraq War, as are Pacific Islanders, greater numbers than we've ever seen. We have a woman here who is a grandmother, who served while she was a grandmother in the Iraq War. A grandmother that had her own career, that had her own way of doing things. And now what has happened to her after going through that war is a very poignant tale. Then we have Sarah Rich. Sarah Rich is the mother of Suzanne Swift, a young woman who was sexually assaulted in Iraq, who went AWOL when she came back because she was put back in the same unit she was in during those assaults. She's in military custody, and her mother is spearheading the drive for all of us to recognize what is happening to, unfortunately, so many women in our military today, sexual harassment and sexual assault in huge numbers that we have to be extraordinarily concerned about. So these are some of the issues that we are going to ask our members of our panel to talk about, and then during the question and answer period at the end of this, I would like for other women vets to add to what they have said, to the extent that you feel comfortable about anything that's happened to you that you want to share. We want you to do that. We also want to encourage people to use this wonderful network that we have through Veterans for Peace for women. We do have email system that women vets can talk to each other, and we want to trade information about where you can go to get the best help for situations that you're facing as a woman vet. So with that, let me ask Colleen to begin our discussion of women's voices. Colleen.
Thank you for being here, and I'm honored to be on this panel. I feel I'm in wonderful company. My story is I was a nurse just out of school and joined the Army and went to Vietnam when I was 21. I graduated from high school at 17, went to a 3-year program, and actually I was 21. I turned 22 over there, and I hadn't been a nurse very long, so I certainly didn't know what I would have to deal with, but I found out soon enough, and I got through it. I was there for a year. I got through it okay, by different methods, partly just becoming a robot, not thinking about what I was doing or what I was seeing. And another way was through humor. We had our little, our little jokes about crispy critters and different types of injuries that made it a little bit easier to handle rather than to really think about what it was, what we were doing, what we were seeing. And most of the guys, and there were Vietnamese too, lots of Vietnamese that we took care of the civilians, most of the guys were, I was 21. I felt like I was an old woman. They were 18 and 19. They were just kids. So anyway, I became a robot, and I just performed my duties and didn't think about it a lot and became really, really, really an adept nurse. I could put in IVs that you can't even touch as a nurse back in the States. I could just whip those things in. But I survived the experience. I wasn't really in a dangerous area. There was only one time where I felt like my life was threatened, so I don't have that baggage of that fear of losing my life to live with. And I didn't know for over 20 years, basically it was 27 years after coming home before I found out I had post-traumatic stress disorder. I knew I had things that would come up that I had a real hard time dealing with, and I knew that I couldn't watch anything having to do with Vietnam or Veterans Day without, falling apart. But I was a nurse. I didn't shoot anybody. I didn't have to live with that guilt. I didn't have to. All I did was take care of the bad stuff and try to make people better. So I never thought that I could even have that as a diagnosis until I agreed to be in a VA study back in New Hampshire in 98 just for a free trip to the East Coast. And after 4 days of grueling testing and psychoanalysis, I was given this diagnosis that hit me like a sledgehammer. It was like I was in shock, and I realized that I didn't necessarily survive the war. But one positive thing was that it kind of made all of my last 27 years kind of make sense about why I had done the things I had done. And anyway, the counselor there at the VA study suggested that I go back to Portland and go to the VA and start getting help. And, you know, my reaction was, there's no way I'm going to do that. I don't want anything to do with any government administration, especially the VA, because all I could remember was those pictures from the Life magazine about these guys that came back and were sitting in their own urine and sitting in filth, and that's what I had. That was my vision of the VA. So I said, well, what else can I do? And she said, read everything you can and talk about it. So that's what I started doing. I started getting books, and I started talking to my family for the first time ever. And, I mean, that felt good. And then went to a retreat for veterans on the Oregon coast, put on by a Buddhist monk who was a Vietnam helicopter crew chief, whatever, anyway, and met up with some other veterans and found out that things weren't as bad as I thought they were as far as getting help from the VA. And I was at the point in my life, as well as my husband, who is also a Vietnam veteran, and we were both dealing with a lot of stuff, and we weren't really dealing with it. So we finally kind of hit our bottom and made a commitment to each other that we were going to go to the VA and get help. And that's been like 5.5 years ago. And I, in June, was granted my 100% disability, 70% post-traumatic stress, and unemployable. I had to give up my nursing career 2.5 years ago, partly because it had been getting harder and harder and harder to be a nurse, to see sick people, to be around anybody that was anything to do with pain or... But the Iraq War sent me into a downward spiral, and I was not functioning as a nursing supervisor. I mean, it was a joke. I'd just hole up in my office, and everybody would be wondering where Colleen was, and, you know, beeping me, and I'd be upset when the beeper went off. Why were they bothering me? But I think there's probably a lot of Vietnam nurse veterans that have post-traumatic stress, but they don't know about it, or they're not dealing with it for the same reason I didn't, because we're the healers. We're not the sick ones. We're the healers. And I know that there's a lot of women serving in Iraq and have served in Iraq, and, you know, you may not necessarily have, you know, had to do anything to do with shooting or killing, or, you know, you may be just driving a truck, or... But if you've seen the devastation from war, you too have PTSD, and so does your family. You know, your family that's waited at home for that phone call or the knock on the door, they're going to have the same trauma. And so we all have to be there for each other. It was other veterans that helped me get help, to know where to go to get help from the VA, because it's not like they advertise it. And so I would be more than happy to answer any questions to anyone afterwards about how to get started or what steps you take to get help, to see somebody. And that's it.
Well, thank you, Colleen. I know it's you know, here it is, 35 years later, and Colleen is finally, she's getting a disability for something that happened because she took other veterans' advice and got some help, found out where to get that help. We'd like to have Ellie Painted Crow tell us about her experiences as a soldier that's come up from the California National Guard as a grandmother and what happened to her in Iraq and then what's happened to her afterwards. Ellie?
Good morning. Just want to say thank you to Ann for inviting me up here and be part of this group. I haven't been in too many groups participating. A couple things with Code Pink, but a lot of this is pretty hard. I was in the Army Reserves, 22 years, a couple years active duty, and had a lot of different jobs from communication. My last job was a truck driver. Prior to that, I was a drill sergeant. So I had a very rigid and strong attitude about military. Also being Native, it is something that we're taught very young. It's a great honor to serve in the armed forces because that is the only thing we have left around us to be warriors. And believe it or not, women have been warriors for a very long time. And so I'm glad to see that this is happening now because somewhere along the way it got changed where we had to be silent, and I was never one of those people. So I'm glad to see that there's more women out here willing to speak up. My tour in Iraq was a real eye-opener for me. Being Native, I'm very sensitive to comments, to subtle messages that are said, and I can feel racism from a very long distance. And I never believed that the military was racist. You know, they tell you when you go in there, you're green or brown or whatever your uniform is, and the color doesn't make a difference. But I found that not to be a very true statement or a reality for me while I was in Iraq, because my biggest enemy was my own company. And I would hear statements, briefings from officers calling enemy territory Indian country. And I found that very shocking. Here I was sitting on this side, and I would wonder, well, what side should I be on then if this is Indian country? Perhaps I'm on the wrong side. And the other thing I faced was racism because I was Native and because I was female. And the interesting thing about that is that the racism that I felt most from was my commander, who was a female and white, and did everything she could to disempower any person of color who was in any kind of position to have any kind of authority. Platoon sergeants were changed over. Our truck master, who was 15 years active duty, was deployed to Baghdad because he was black. Our maintenance NCOs, everybody who was of color, what they were ordered to do was to train a white soldier who was not MOSQ'd, who was not trained in that job. And if they did a good job in training that soldier, then the person that did the training could stay as an assistant. As a result of that, I ended up standing up for one of my soldiers who was an E5, a black E5 NCO, and he was admin, and our commander sent him on leave and came back and told him that he no longer had the job, but his job was not to train a white soldier. He refused and asked to go to JAG, and was denied JAG. At the same time, she really didn't like women. Here was an officer who was not upholding the no alcohol policy because she was getting drunk with soldiers, and she was demeaning women soldiers in every opportunity. I was an E7, and there was only one other E7, and everybody else was an E4, all the other females. So a lot of the times they would come and say, "Sergeant Painted Crow, this is going on. What do I do?" And at some point, she saw the power that E7 NCO has over, you know, privates and E4s as far as, you know, them respecting them. And so what she decided to do was to take away our power base. And the way that she did that was that she she moved all the E7s into private's tents and broke our sense of power. If you don't know anything about military structure, I'm sure everybody does. NCOs have different places in terms of where they live, and privates and E4s and below have different places because there's things that NCOs talk about, things that NCOs have to do that are different. In doing this, what happens, instead of getting the privates to move into our tents, we had to move into theirs. We lost every piece of authority that we ever had, and I actually found myself arguing with E4s and E3s. That was just, you know, other things that happened. Really upset me to the point where I really wanted to hurt my commander. After seeing all the things she was doing to all these soldiers, and everybody felt pretty helpless because the battalion commander was supporting this. The fact that she was court-martialing and giving Article 15s for soldiers who were drinking when there was alcohol in her breath was just beside me. I couldn't take it. So I stood up to her, and my first sergeant tried to stand up to her, but in the end they were going to Article 15 him, so he backed down. And the NCO that was requesting JAG and was denied was getting shipped to a place called Scania. And if anybody knows Scania, it's known for mortars. And you get to go to Scania when you're in trouble and you haven't followed the rules. So he was going to Scania. And I went to the IG to talk to somebody, EEO, to talk to somebody. And the next thing I know, I was going to Scania with this NCO. We asked again to see JAG. They said no, that we would have to move out at 5:00 in the morning to the next convoy. And the sergeant said, "What do I do, Sergeant Painter-Crow?" And I said, "Well, we're not leaving. We're going to miss movement until we see JAG. Because once we get out there, we don't know when we'll see JAG. We're not sure when that's going to happen." So what ended up happening is they tried to court-martial me, give me Article 15. They couldn't do either because I challenged the commander and we got kicked out, went to Scania and stayed there. So that's my little story about racism. It goes on to a lot of other things, but there's so much I need to talk about. The other thing I want to talk about is rape that happens out there. And there are women being raped by our own soldiers. And it is not being addressed appropriately. I used to be an associate director to sexual assault. I am a victim of sexual assault. Or actually, I'm a survivor of sexual assault. I'm not a victim to anything. And sexual assault happens quite a bit in the military, but you don't ever talk about it with anybody, number one, because most of the people that you have to talk about it with are men, and they minimize it. This was the case in my unit. We had some soldiers early on coming to me and saying, "Sergeant Painter-Crow, this guy is saying this about this other woman," and really terrible language about what they were going to do to these women, young women, you know, 20 years old, and they would come to me and say, "What do I do?" So I took it to the first sergeant, took it to the commander, and the statement was actually they were talking about anal intercourse. And I went to the first sergeant and I said, "This is what is being said by these sergeants to these E4s." And my first sergeant's reply was, "Well, tell them to walk with their back against the wall," was how to handle it. And so I decided that we needed to take charge of ourselves. And so myself and another E7 that was there at the time, Sergeant Ward, we were the highest ranking there. So we took all these females and we went to I forget the office, EEO or whatever that is, and we took all the women out there. We had them all write statements. And got a lot of people upset because we relieved 4 commanders and 4 first sergeants in the first 3 months that we were deployed. Wow. So I'm not very well liked by the higher echelon. But I really don't care at this point. I didn't care at that point either. I mean, I actually thought about going AWOL because of the commander and the leadership and myself and the other E7 that was there. We had a plan to go to Italy, and then the trains blew up in Italy. I thought, well, we can't go there. You know, rape happens a lot. There was a rape incident when I was in Cedar 2. And the way that they handled it was very poorly. They sent a CID female, probably about 21, to come and give a teaching about what sexual assault was about, and basically her teaching was about that there's a bunch of horny guys, so you guys have to be careful. And if you know anything about sexual assault, it's not about that at all. It's about power and control. It's about anger, internalized anger. And she gave this teaching, and I was just shocked because, number one, I think that sexual assault training needs to be for men and for women also, and all we had was women there. And the way that she minimized and almost victimized the person who was raped in the way that she was speaking, not about her personally, but just the way that she handled it. I felt duty-bound after the whole training to go up to her and say, what is your experience and what do you know? Because everything you're teaching is incorrect. And I want to know who your supervisor is, because you are not teaching these women how to protect themselves. You're not teaching them what it's about. And really, the men need to know about this. So why are we only having women here? She was very defensive, young soldier. You know, I wasn't trying to challenge her. I was just trying to educate her. But like I said, I was a drill sergeant, and I just have this way about me sometimes in a uniform. And I ended up researching that and sending that up to headquarters, up in Tulil, to educate them about the trainings they were presenting. I don't know if it got better or if it didn't, but I got banned from that company, that camp soon after that, so I didn't get to follow up. But what I will tell you is that women are set up to get raped. They tell you you need to have a battle buddy to go to the latrine, to go to the shower. And then what they do is I found several companies while I was in Scania, because it was a transient company, a transient base camp where soldiers came in, ate, refueled, spent the night in a sort of a Motel 6 kind of place. You know, civilians run that really now. And what I found was there were a lot of women that would come through very young who were in an all-male company. So they had no battle buddies. And they were constantly harassed, constantly. I had one soldier come up to me, and actually I met her again when I came back to state, Fort Bliss. She was sent to me because at that point I was working for the mayor's cell, and my job was to supervise the details that were going out of the base camp. And give them a briefing and brief them when they came back. And this one soldier had gotten in trouble. She was in an all-male company, and they sent her to me, and they gave me a note, and they said, we want her to clean latrines for 21 days. And if you know anything about cleaning latrines, Iraqis clean latrines, and soldiers supervise them. That's our job now. And so you have these three details, and you actually have to go off the camp out into the fields to dump, because they have to clean out the latrines. You have to go dump them out at the site. So you actually have to go out of the base camp away from supervision. It's just, you know, you and the truck, and there's an Iraqi soldier or Iraqi employee on each side of you. And they wanted to send her out there by herself with these men. And I went up to the person that sent me that note. I said, I'm not going to do it. And they said, well, you're going to have to talk to the captain because this is her punishment. I said, I don't care what you think. I went to the sergeant major, and we removed her from that duty and gave her a different one because I was not about to put her in danger. A few months later, or actually a year later, I ran into her again, and they were trying to kick her out of the Army for that. And the commander had written a lot of bad things about her, and she was at the medical hold, and the commander there, I was working for him at the time because I was on medical hold myself. And he came up and says, you know this soldier? I said, yes, I do, sir. And if it wasn't for the fact that I had written everything down that had happened and gave it to him, she would have been kicked out of the Army. That's not, she didn't want that. So I wanted to honor what she wanted. But they were setting her up, and they did a really good job. But she got to stay in after I talked to the commander and explained to them what was going on with her. And this is not an isolated case. This happens a lot to women out there. The other thing I want to talk about, there's so much, I just don't know. In terms of how they deal with the women, I was noticing how they deal for the holiday of, I just want to make a mention of this, the holiday of Memorial Day when they were having this thing on television and they were showing all these soldiers from Iraq saying, "Mom, my husband, my wife, my kids." What I really noticed is they didn't show any married women out there saying, "This is for my husband, I miss you, I miss my kids," and there's a lot of married women out there. And so they really do a lot to erase that, and we need to bring that up. If you're married and you've been in Iraq, then you need to talk about that, because that's the one thing you never see. You don't know about the moms that are coming home with no legs or no arms, or severely with PTSD where they can't deal with their children anymore. I have 7 grandchildren and 2 sons, who served in the military, one for 11 years and one for 2. So like I said, as a Native, that's what we do. And my own story, I came home to nothing. I used to do a lot of teachings with women. I held circles, I held health ceremony, and would travel around doing retreats for women and teaching empowerment, teaching finding your voice, because we've lost that in this culture, in this society, in this Western culture. And when I came back, I couldn't even deal with the circle that I had left behind, and they felt very abandoned. And I used to have a lot of women living in my home. By the time I came home, they couldn't even talk to me anymore because I was so angry, and I couldn't deal with any of the pettiness. To me, everything they talked about anymore was petty. I didn't want to hear it. I lost connection with my mother, my brothers, my sons, my boyfriend. Everybody, and I felt myself alone. And the other thing that really happened to me that I just recently came to my mind was, while I was in Iraq, I suffered from something called endometriosis, a women's illness, a disease that grows in your uterus. And prior to shipping out, I went to the doctor on base, and I said, "Look, I have this problem. I have severe uterine bleeding, and I need to be treated for it specifically, and I'm not going to get that treatment out there." And they said, "Oh, no." They did all these tests that actually said nothing, because I took these things back to the VA, and they said, "These reports actually don't say a darn thing about you. Just a lot of big words that nobody could understand, and nobody would admit that they could understand." So they sent me to Iraq anyway. And as a result of that, they deemed me fit for duty, and I just found the paper the other day, and I was shocked to even remember this, is that I came home on leave and I ended up having a hysterectomy because there were no doctors to treat me out there. They were calling Germany to find out what to do for me. They were giving me shots and putting me on bed rest 3 days out of the week because I couldn't walk. The pain was so severe. And I'm really angry right now because my uterus didn't have to leave my body. And for Native people, that's a very important thing, because my uterus is where my children were made. My uterus going into menopause is a ceremony that puts me into grandmother lodge. I don't get to have that ceremony now. I have to do something different. And there's a lot of things that were taken behind that uterus, and it wasn't just a part that didn't work anymore that could be taken out. And I want to say that if I bet it was something wrong with somebody having I don't know what the disease is for men, but if they would have had that, I know they wouldn't go. You know, I know that because there was a first sergeant who didn't go because he had to have a surgery because he had prostate cancer. They weren't sure, and they wanted to make sure. And he didn't ship, but I did. So there's still a lot of unbalance in how they deal with that. And the reason that I shipped was because you need 84% in order to ship of soldiers. We were short 3. I was number 3. And if they would have deemed me unfit, my unit wouldn't have went, and they were dying to get out there. They were just wanting to get out there. They were teaching us how to hate. So that's the other thing. I'll tell you what my status is right now. When I left, my career has been as a social worker, as an alcohol drug counselor, dual diagnosis. I know about PTSD because I used to work with people who had it. And I've come back, and I'm no longer able to work. And I'm no longer able to work. I've had to demand. See, I don't accept what the VA has to offer. You're going to give me what I want. If I gave you what you wanted, you're going to give me what I want. I don't care. And I went there, and they said, you know, only men therapists. I said, nope, want a woman. It took me 3 months, got it. They said, oh, disability, state disability, you can only get $25 a week. I said, nope, wrote a letter to Governor Schwarzenegger. I got $750 every 2 weeks after my letter to Arnold. But as it stands at this point, I lost my disability because I ran out of funds. The military does not feed into disability, so you can't get state disability, and I've been waiting for my claim since October. I've been waiting for SSI since June, and I'm currently living on $164 of food stamps and $263 of general assistance. So this is what the Army has done for me. I do have a home. And I'm selling that home so that I can live. And I want to say that I know I'm not the only soldier that's going through this, because my friend 3 months ago that I served in Iraq with came home a year ago. And they found her dead in her home, and she'd been dead for 2 days. Because she had PTSD so bad and depression, and she couldn't tell anybody because there was nobody to tell. And she was a lieutenant, and she was my good friend. And so I just want you to know that the war isn't over when you come home, because it's a new war that starts. And I'm glad to see that women are here and speaking. Because it's going to be the women who heal the earth. And we all have to take a stand. Women, in the ancient days, they're the ones who dictated when we went to die in my culture. We were matriarchal. We have to find that. Because we're the healers. We give life. We don't want to take it anymore. Thank you.
Well, everybody take a deep breath. My. Thank you, Ellie. Thank you. Well, as many of you all have seen in your own lives, when you've come home, your life is not the same. We'll now hear from a mother who can tell you about her daughter, whose life is not the same, after she came back from Iraq after having been sexually assaulted there. Sarah Rich has been leading the charge for all of us to help her daughter and other women's and men's daughters who have suffered such horrible things when they've joined the military and have gone to Iraq and other places and have suffered horrible sexual assaults. Sarah, we thank you on behalf of all mothers for what you're doing for your daughter, and we stand ready to help you.
Well, now I'm all even more fired up. Every time I hit this plateau of being so pissed off, I just get even more pissed off. I'm just going to tell you the story about my daughter, who rocks. She is my hero. I cut all my hair off because I was so stressed out after she was arrested that I just had to cut it off, because I do this a lot when I'm really stressed. So if I do this a lot, just ignore it. I don't have fleas or anything. I'm just angry. So my daughter was 18. She graduated from high school. She had a dead-end job, and she's like, the military recruiter called our house because they have our home phone number, and said, let me take you out to lunch. And the courtship began. They started telling her all the things that she would get if she came and joined the military. I was raised partially by my grandpa, who was a colonel in the military, and I really had this faith that it would turn her around and she would find some discipline and some good order. And make her life go the way she wanted to, motivate her. I said, but hey, you might go to Iraq. And she said, no. She said, they told me that if I sign up for 5 years, I could be an MP, and MPs are never go to Iraq. And I said, oh, wow. But 5 years, that's a long time. She says, yeah, but it's worth it if I don't have to go over there. And I said, well, yeah, I guess so. Okay. So I have this little raging stepmom named Kayla, and Kayla was sending her stuff every day, which, you know, this is the stuff I do now in counter-military recruiting. You know, she's sending her every day, this is going to happen, this can happen, this can happen. Suzanne's like, eh, no. And I, you know, I'm not going to change Suzanne's mind. I never have been and never will. So she left for basic training at 19 and completed her basic training in her AIT, is that what it's called, at Fort Leonard Wood, and they told her that she was going to Iraq. So she got out, and she came home for a month. And it was really interesting because this one sergeant kept calling the house and calling her cell phone to check in on her, make sure she was okay, make sure she was safe. Did you get there okay? When are you heading back? I was calling her a couple times a day, and I was like, wow, this guy really cares about my kid. We go up, we say goodbye to her, she goes off, and the minute she sets foot on foreign soil, the sergeant who looked at me in the face and said, don't worry, ma'am, we're going to take good care of your daughter, who was her platoon sergeant, said, why do you keep looking at me, Swift, like you want to fuck me? And she said, I don't know what you're talking about, and went off. The next day, he pulls her into the Humvee as they drive from Kuwait to Iraq. Does that sound familiar? And they got the headphones on in the Humvee, and they're going, and he's talking to her about keeping a secret and engaging in a sexual relationship with this platoon sergeant. She was scared to death because it was just the two of them. And they get to Karbala in Camp Lima, and she goes to her EO, her equal opportunity officer, and says, this is what's going on. This is what this guy is doing to me. The EO basically said, nothing's going to, you know, ignore it. I can't help you, you know, and basically dismissed her. What that does, I've learned a lot in the last 3 years about the military. What that does is it basically gives a green light to anybody that's a sergeant, an NCO, that's a green light that nobody's going to help this private. And she is basically free game. So what I've heard about is that there's, you know, these seasoned NCO sergeants, male sergeants, that make bets about which one of them can make which private their private. And they separate the women. They put them in different rooms so that they have easy access to them. So this is what happened to Suzanne. Her squad leader, or her first, she had a couple of squad leaders, but her initial squad leader was a first sergeant. And he started grooming her to be his private deployment girlfriend, I guess is what it's called. And she kept saying, no, 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 you know, I'm not interested. You know, and both of these men, the platoon sergeant and the squad leader, married. I know their wives. I've always, you know, been a breath away from sending them letters about their husbands. I have pictures of their children, too, and that just, it just gets me. So she gets coerced into a sexual relationship that lasts for 3 months with this molester. And what I've learned since then, and he'd do nasty things to her and come to her room in the middle of the night drunk, and then what he would do and this platoon sergeant would do is they'd punish her and make her look like a bad soldier. They'd make her do PT until she threw up in the mud and behind the barracks, behind the rooms, the, you know, whatever their trailers or whatever they are, in the mud, and then, you know, do a PT test with her the next day, and she'd fail, you know, and just write her up for everything he could. Finally, he went on leave. He went on R&R, and he came back, and she said, it's over. Leave me alone. Don't touch me. Don't come near me. And then the punishment really began. And so from then on, she was subjected to ridicule and harassment. You know, she said, basically, Mom, everybody here, you know, all the women are either whores or c***s or bitches or lesbians. You know, that's what we are. And they cannot treat us like human beings unless they want to treat us like a man, you know. So I had everything ready in November of 04 to write, to deal with the Congress to try and help her. And she said, oh, God, no, you can't do that. If you do that, I might die. They might kill me. And I said, wait a minute. I said, really, I need to do something. She says, just, you know, send me some more books. Send me some more Rice Krispie treats. That's all I can do right now. So there she is. She starts to get really depressed over there. She doesn't leave her room unless she absolutely has to. They sabotage her, as in, you know, show up at this time or don't show up at that time. And, you know, once she showed up 30 seconds late, and I don't know if you know the story, that the first sergeant made her wear a wall carry a wall clock with her for indefinite amount of time. And so everywhere she went, she had to carry this wall clock. And then the story that most people don't know is that one night she took that wall clock and she went to his room and knocked at his door and threw it at him and said, just take your clock. I'm not doing it anymore. So she gets real depressed, and she comes home, finally, a year after. And I said, you ready? Can I do something? Please let me do something. She's like, no, don't do anything. I can't handle it. You know, I just can't handle it. Let me just put my head down. And she went about her job as a military police officer at Fort Lewis. So she's home for about a month. She has a new squad leader, and she goes to him and she says, Sergeant, where am I supposed to report in the morning? And there's a bunch of people there, and he said, in my bed naked. And she just had it. She said, forget it. And she went, she broke the chain of command and went and told. They were both interrogated. He was moved to Yakima, someplace in Yakima, and she was treated like a traitor for months. Would call me crying that nobody would talk to her, that she was ostracized, that she, basically, you're a traitor if you tell. You're a traitor. So I said, are you ready to deal with this? Please, can we do something now? And she's like, no, Mom, please, I just can't handle it. So, because the reason she can't handle it is because she knows she has to go back to Iraq. She has 18 months of stabilization time that she needs to hold tight and be strong. So she comes home about 9 months after she got back, and she said, well, they're sending me back early. I said, whoa, they can't do that. They can't do that to you. She said, no, they got in my face. I tried to refuse to sign the waiver releasing my right to 18 months of stabilization time, and they're sending me back 11 months later. And I said, oh, hell no. So anyway, so she was ready to go. We had our, you know, our hotel arrangements. We were going to come say goodbye to her. You know, I'm looking at her saying, you don't have to do this. And she's like, no, I have to do this. I'm not going to, you know, it's my duty. I'm like, okay. So 3 days before she is supposed to redeploy, she's got everything in her car. She'd been home, brought all her stuff home, you know, already had sent her stuff over. You know, you send your stuff over ahead of time. And she turned to me, she with her keys in her hands, she said, I can't go back, I just can't do it. I said, oh, thank God, finally I could do something. So she went in to see a psychologist, got diagnosed with PTSD, and got an attorney, and started, you know, went into hiding, basically. And then 6 months later, she was arrested in my home and taken to jail. She was arrested by Eugene Police Department. She was taken to jail, where she was orifice checked and strip searched and denied medical care, and she had an abscessed tooth. And then they came and got her and took her to Fort Lewis and put her back under the command of that platoon sergeant that was asking her for sex at the beginning. And our attorney said no, and we had to get Patty Murray's office in there to get her moved, and now there's a no-contact order. So what I've learned in this time since she was arrested is about command rape and about military sexual trauma, which are things I had no idea about. Oh, let me backtrack. I forgot to say that right before she was going to be redeployed, something that triggered her is they were on a training mission out in Yakima, and a male sergeant raped a male specialist out in the field at night. And so they all had to do this sexual assault training that you were talking about. And they sat there, and the man that was was raped had to leave crying, and a couple other women had to leave crying because it was triggering all of them and their military sexual trauma experiences. So they all had to go through this training, and Suzanne says, holy shit, Mom, let me tell you about what happened. And I was like, oh, you know, I said, how are you doing? She says, I'm all right. So she went AWOL, she got arrested, She's at Fort Lewis. She's they put her back on weed and seed duty, and we have an attorney, and we're trying to get her an honorable discharge for everything that's happened to her. The molester and the sergeant here have left the Army, and one is working for Blackwater, making $15,000 a month. The other one is, I don't know where he is, but the platoon sergeant is still there at Fort Lewis. So that is my daughter's story. She is holding tight. Her depression is it goes up and down. Her anger about everything. You know, it was interesting when she was a soldier, when she was, before she went AWOL, she just kind of put her head down and didn't pay attention to the news and to politics and to what was going on. And now she's had some time to do that. And I can't tell you how bad she wants to be here today. She wants to be here so bad. And we have lots of talks and lots of discussions about what we're going to do the minute she gets that discharge and how we're going to just rock this whole place down. I just can't even tell you. So, thanks.
Thank you, Sarah. And now you see what happens to the families at home that know something's going on, and how do you help those that are in the military? It's an odd psychology, isn't it? When we get into the military, sometimes you don't want to fight against the system. And you let the system kind of keep running over you, until finally there is a point when you say, no, it's not going to happen anymore. And that's what Suzanne has now said. And she endured a hell of a lot for a year and a half. Things that she, of course, should not have had to endure, because good leadership doesn't let that stuff happen in your unit. But as we're seeing now, our military is really at a precipitous place. Our military, our professional military, is no longer professional. It has leaders in it that have no moral courage, that have no concern for the men and women under their command, and they are allowing it, condoning things that are criminal activities in their unit. Sexual assault is a crime, and yet it's being condoned by the leadership of many of these units. And you cannot tell me that any leader in those units can get away with saying, I didn't know, because they know. They know. Now, could we ask for questions from the audience? Okay.
My question is for Ellie Painted Crow, since you're the only one who's been in Iraq, I believe, as a soldier. You talked about the rape on the bases. What about rape of Iraqi women as an instrument of war? Could you talk about that and whatever experience you have with that? Thank you.
Well, the experience that I have around that is I've made friends with Iraqi women through Code Pink that are from Iraq. While I was there, I didn't see the women because you just didn't see them. It was all the men that did the work. But I can't say that it doesn't happen. I'm sure that it is. And one of the questions that was asked by Mr. Eldridge, a guy who wrote a book, I don't remember his first name, his question to me was, were there any brothels there for the men? And I said, no. And that was a very interesting point for him. He was like, oh, when we were in Vietnam, they had brothels for the men. So what are they doing out there? I said, well, I don't know. You can guess. What I do know that they were doing is that there were women from third world countries, the Philippines, things like that, places like that, and they were being hired to work as in the laundromats to wash the clothes for the soldiers. And they were prostituting them to the men there. At some point, somebody found out, and what they ended up doing was putting a big fence around where they lived so that they had to be escorted in and escorted out. So they got a job, but it was like in jail. That's not to say that it still didn't happen, because, soldiers can be persistent in getting what they want. And these women actually went there knowing that was going to happen. And maybe not initially, but once they were there. I know that a couple times people got arrested because women were being found with like $35,000 on their possession for prostitution. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I'm answering your question. I know that's how they're dealing with that as far as women being raped, Iraqi women. That's what I've been hearing since I've been there, that they've been stealing the young girls from school, that they don't even send the girls to school anymore because of that, because they don't come home and they don't know what happens to them.
Thank you.
Marisela Guzman. I served in the U.S. Navy from 1998 to 2002. And I just came out, I guess, in the sense that something happened to me when I was in boot camp. And I was in Denial for so long that I became a workaholic, top sailor. And when I got out, I thought everything was going to be better. But the reason I came out was because I heard another woman talk about her experience four or five times before I broke down and said, wait a minute, this happened to me. So I was a coward because I didn't stand up when I was in the military, and I feel ashamed of that. And I know I'm not ashamed, but I'm trying to tell you that you're using your voices as tools to help other women that at that time when that happened to them, they didn't have a voice. So thank you. Saved my life, so thank you.
You know, it was interesting. My daughter did an interview the other day, and she said, you know, I still feel like it's my fault. You know, and that's part of, you know, understanding and educating about military sexual trauma and command rape. Is you, once you put that, click it, then it gives you some power to deal with, you know, how what happened to you and how that went down. You know, we have had hundreds of women write to us since Suzanne got arrested and tell us their story and how ashamed and how sad and how it's affected their life. And you know, on some level, I knew what was going on with Suzanne, but I didn't understand it. You know, it's like knowing about domestic violence and not knowing that it's not your fault. You know, it's a very, very nasty, manipulative sadness. It's just really horrible. My heart goes out to you.
Yep. Our heart goes out to you, and you're a courageous woman to stand right there and let us know. And for everyone that stands up to say that's happened to me or I know somebody it's happened to, then slowly but surely we're going to get this stopped. Yep. So we thank you for doing that.
It's happening right now. It's happening in LaWanda in Afghanistan. It just happened to Jessica in South Korea. You know, we're getting emails from soldiers that's happening to right now. And LaWanda just tried to commit suicide the other day because she's so desperate to get out of there.
Yeah.
It's really hardcore.
This one woman that she's referring to that was in South Korea, after a barrage of emails, we got up to the 3-star general in charge of her. Within 1 week, we got her out of where she was and back to the United States and discharged. So we are working. We, by God, will get these women out of that.